We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. I'm joined by my co-host, Conrad.
Hello.
And in this episode, we're delighted to be joined by Fergus Much, who is the SNP's candidate for the Holyrood seat of Aberdeenshire West. Welcome to the podcast, Fergus.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So the first question that I'd like to ask, Fergus, is the last UK-wide general election, you stood in West Aberdeenshire and Kincaid for the SNP. And very
Kincaid,
nearly...
Kincaid. West Kincaid. Aberdeenshire and Kincaid, yeah.
I'm sorry. Kincaid. And you stood against the incumbent Conservative MP, Andrew Bowie. You very nearly won the seat. If you are to succeed and win the Holyrood seat of West Aberdeenshire, would that mean that you wouldn't stand again in 2024 for the parliamentary seat? Or have you got potential plans that you may stand for that seat in 2024?
No, my focus is purely on winning the Aberdeenshire West seat for Holyrood. For the SNP, obviously, you know, we believe that the Holyrood is where the big decisions affecting Scotland should be made, if not in all cases are made. It was a great experience for me in 2019, having my first kind of crack at a Westminster election. We did very well. We cut a really safe Tory majority of almost 8,000 votes down to just 843 vote Tory majority. That number is seared upon my my soul forevermore. It's a really tight margin, really close election. And sure, you know, I learned a lot as a candidate, a lot about the priorities of this area. It's a slightly different constituency for Holyrood. We lose the southern part of the constituency, gain a bit from the top. But no, I think my focus is Holyrood. So if elected in May, I can't imagine that I would be putting myself forward for a Westminster election again. Of course, you know, it's the SNP's ambition that we won't have another Westminster election, because if we win a pro-independence majority this May, then we will be having another independence referendum. And hopefully the need to send MPs to Westminster in future is not required.
Now, obviously, as you mentioned, the seats aren't exactly the same areas, but there's a lot of overlap with Andrew Bowie's seat. Would you feel like you'd be able to work with him on local issues that come up, considering you've ran against him before?
Yeah, I think Andrew and I have distinctly different priorities, but we're both, you know, Northeast guys through and through. I think, you know, he you know, on a personal level, I get on absolutely fine with Andrew. I think, you know, where Aberdeenshire's interests are obvious, and, you know, fulfilling our potential and bringing about change, then sure, I'm willing to work with anybody in those circumstances. I do think that Andrew Bowie perhaps enjoys the kind of cut and thrust of Westminster a bit too much, and perhaps doesn't focus on the constituency stuff as much as he might. But you know, that's for him to decide his own priorities.
Now, going on to constituency issues, of course, coronavirus has impacted the entire United Kingdom. It's impacted the entire world. What kind of impact do you think it's had on West Aberdeenshire? And what do you think are going to be the issues going forward into the future that you think you would have to deal with if you are elected to Holyrood, falling out from the coronavirus pandemic?
I think a huge impact, and, you know, no part of the UK has been immune from the pressures, the challenges of COVID-19. For businesses who've had to close their doors and adapt, it's been particularly tough. Aberdeenshire West is a kind of tourism hotspot. We've got Royal Dee Side, which is a real draw. People come from all over the world to enjoy this part of the world, to go climbing the hills in the Cairngorms. There's the sort of royal appeal. You know, the Queen comes here for her holidays, and so do a lot of other people. So I think hospitality in particular has been very acutely affected. They've had to adapt and change, and, you know, do so to varying degrees of lockdown, level systems, new restrictions in place, and actually for them, having had to furlough their staff and face extreme pressure over the last year, it's imperative that as soon as it is safe to open, that they're given the support they need. I think universally, almost across the UK, high streets have been in decline over the last 20, 30 years. And when shops haven't been able to open the doors, that's been really bad news. It's compounded existing imbalances. The big online retailers like Amazon have been on the ascendancy versus small family-run businesses over the last couple of years. Mm. And actually, this has probably cast in fairly sharp relief the real imbalance there, the real unfairness of a small family firm paying more in rates and taxes in the local area than big delivery companies who do have the upper hand and have frankly filled their boots over the last year and made incredible profits. I'm not going to say for a second that I don't get deliveries from Amazon once in a while. Everybody does, really. It's the way we live now. But actually leveling that playing field between small family run firms and the big multinational retailers is something that I think really needs to change.
The other big issues in recent years, especially in the last year or so, has been Brexit. The Northeast was out of Scotland, one of the highest voting areas for Brexit, although obviously most areas still remain in a majority. So how do you think your rejoined message will appeal in this area?
Well, I think it does. Actually, the Aberdeenshire West area was probably about in line with the Scottish average when it came to Brexit. So, I would expect in the part of Aberdeenshire I'm seeking to represent, there would have been about a 60% Remain vote, a 40% Leave vote. Other parts of Aberdeenshire, sure, Banff and Buchan, the fishing territory, they did vote for Brexit. I'm quite confident that that's a very popular message. The SNP wants to be back in Europe. It wants to be an equal partner in Europe. Since 2016, we came forward with compromise proposals to remain within the single market and the customs union. Those have been ignored at every turn. And I think that, one, there is a sense of Europeanness. There's plenty of EU nationals living in Aberdeenshire that have come here to work. We've got two universities in the Northeast. We've got the oil and gas sector and the energy sector, which attracts people from all around the world. Brexit doesn't make those exchanges of people, of ideas, of knowledge any easier. And actually for the farming sector in particular, so let's take, for example, the beef cattle sector in the Northeast. They rely on a huge export market to Europe. The high value markets are France, Italy, Spain. And if they can't export that product with ease, then the whole supply chain and the whole of Northeast agriculture suffers as a result. So there's various factors to it. But yes, I think being back in the EU is a message that resonates extremely well with constituents across Aberdeenshire West.
Now, of course, on the point of cattle rearing, Aberdeenshire is, of course, famous for Angus beef. I wonder, in terms of cattle farming and cattle rearing, what impact do you think that has had on the environment? And what would you seek to do if you became a Holyrood MSP to working with local farmers to reduce the impact on climate change of cattle farming?
It's an interesting point, and I think that more so than ever before, people Scotland-wide, UK-wide, but particularly in the Northeast, are very, very conscious of the impact of climate change and our environment, particularly younger people too. I think the context of COP26 in Glasgow this year is a really good opportunity for Scotland to sort of showcase our world-leading climate ambitions to the rest of the world. agriculture is often an easy target for emissions. That said, you know, perhaps a lesson for all of us is that locally sourced meat, eating better quality, organic, locally sourced meat is better for the environment than importing, you know, huge amounts of meat from across the world, intensively reared stuff, and actually knowing where your you know, the food you eat is coming from is a good thing, and much more people are interested in that. I think actually over the last year, obviously it's been a terrible time, but actually it's made people pause for thought on a lot of these issues. The farming sector, I know, is particularly keen to do what they can to reduce emissions. And yeah, you know, if elected in May, I'll be working with them to ensure that happens.
If you become an MSP, you'll be responsible for the laws passing through the Scottish Parliament. One law that's passing through at the moment, and obviously that'll presumably gone through by the time you get in there, but I'm sure you still have a view on it, is the hate crime bill. Now, people have expressed concerns about this bill in terms of impacts on free speech. What is your view on the impact of this bill and what it means for free speech and other issues?
So there was a requirement for a hate crime bill to consolidate existing legislation and introduce measures to, you know, I think, strike the right balance between free speech and you know, categories of hate crime. I think the legislation, when it was first introduced to Parliament, and it is coming for a lot of flack, was actually a very badly drafted piece of legislation. I look at it, one, with a kind of policy hat on, but, you know, my background is in law as well, and I think that there could have been, you know, several unintended consequences of the bill as introduced. You know, the Justice Secretary Hamza Yousaf, who brought forward the bill, has faced a lot of personal flack for it. However, at every stage, he's been very, very willing to seek compromise and change, and actually, I think that shows the Scottish Parliament in its best light. The SNP does not have a majority. We can't just railroad through legislation. We need to find compromise. We need to have discussion. We need to subject legislation to scrutiny. And in this case, it's been that process has been done in a really good way. Although, of course, you know, it's politics too. So there's been you know, plenty of the sort of parliamentary ding dong over this bit of legislation too.
Now, regarding legislation that it may be difficult to pass in a minority, I was reading an interesting article in Prospect earlier regarding land ownership in Scotland, which stated that it's estimated that around 25% of estates, over 1,000 acres in Scotland, have been in the hands of the same family for more than 400 years, and that some 41% of properties and a staggering 72% of Scotland's total land mass is missing from the Scottish land registry. Given that there have been issues relating in terms of who owns land, both to climate change and housing, what do you think can be done by potentially a majority SNP government, or maybe even working in a minority with other parties in the Scottish Parliament, to rectify the land inequality that exists in Scotland?
I think Scotland's land ownership and land reform journey has been really, really interesting. It's perhaps not been as ambitious as I might have hoped for over the years since devolution. There is, you know, the starting point here is there is, as you say, a chronic imbalance in land ownership in Scotland. Big estates dominate the landscape, particularly here in Aberdeenshire West. There needs to be transparency in who owns the land, and, you know, there's work to be done in the land registry. But there's also, I think, more support needing to be given to communities to bring land into local ownership. The SNP previously set an ambition of 1 million acres in public ownership, which, you know, I think tragically has kind of fallen by the wayside. You know, I'd like to see that ambition resurrected. I'd like to see it, you know, it doubled, and I'd like to see a lot more land in public ownership. Grouse moorland is not an efficient way to manage land by and large. Okay, sure, there's good landowners and there's bad, but actually, it's not particularly environmentally friendly in some cases. It doesn't provide much economic benefit for communities. It doesn't employ that many people. So actually having a diversity on some of these big estates, and we're talking 50,000 acre estates here, where they have land freed up for local housing, and that's an issue for young people in rural Scotland, for community renewable projects, wind turbines, and small community hydro schemes that can make a big difference in injecting some cash into rural and remote communities. More forestry. The natural landscape in Scotland was a vast Caledonian pine forest at one stage. There's been deforestation in Scotland over 2,000 years. The landscape of those sort of windswept moorlands that you associate with Scotland are not natural landscapes, and actually they aren't the best in terms of biodiversity, and Scotland tackling its climate change targets either. So yeah, plant more forestry, use the land for a diversity of purposes, and critically get more of it into public ownership.
We're going to take a short break from our conversation with Fergus to hear a trailer for the Politics of Sound podcast episode with Lawrence Fox. When we come back, we'll be asking Fergus about internal SNP matters relating to Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon, Joanna Cherry, amongst others. I hope you enjoy listening to that when we come back in a moment.
Do you want to see your politicians from a different angle? It's time for the Politics of Sound podcast. I believe that people's record collections can reveal a lot about them, and so every month I invite politicians and political figures to reveal their three all-time favourite albums, and in exchange, I want to know all about them and their lives, what they think, and why they think it. My guest for the March episode is Lawrence Fox.
I've always thought what I think.
No, I'm not sorry. I do believe it. And you know what? I believe it even more today than I did.
I think Twitter's a sewer.
I'm sorry, that's not how democracy works.
Oh, God, who said it? I've gone woke.
And it's not like I was saying anything controversial.
The Politics of Sound podcast with my guest, Lawrence Fox, out March the 1st on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
An issue within the SNP that sort of had a spark some lot of discussion is the sacking of Joanna Cherry. What are your views on her sacking and her like opinions on things like transgender rights and sort of more aggressive stance on independence maybe than Nicola Sturgeon has?
Yeah, Joanna is a politician that I have a huge amount of respect for. She obviously took the UK government all the way to the Supreme Court and won in one of the most incredible historic cases in British legal history in recent years. She's a sharp intellect. She's extremely passionate about the causes that she believes in. I genuinely believe that there is space for a variety of views on a variety of subjects in the SNP. I think we've always prided ourselves on being a fairly broad church united by belief in independence, how we get there, how quickly that is, what the process for that is of course a matter for debate amongst our membership and amongst our elected politicians. The decision to remove Joanna Cherry from the front bench is a matter for our Westminster leader, Ian Blackford. It is what it is. And he has he has the right to choose his team. But actually I would like to see a variety of voices, dissenting and otherwise, represented throughout the SNP. One thing I will say in balance to that is that often these debates are best held by parties behind closed doors or a party conference, and the sort of briefing and tittle tattle about colleagues that sometimes goes with these things in the press perhaps isn't my way of approaching these matters and doesn't necessarily lead to good feeling within the party. So yeah, I think it wasn't the best of kind of outcomes, I don't think. But I think the party, generally speaking, despite some pretty tough challenges over the last year is in Fine Fettle, and there's real trust in the leadership of Nicola Sturgeon as we go into a historic election for the SNP.
On the point of Ian Blackford and his responsibilities as leader of the SNP in Westminster, today Patrick Grady, the SNP chief whip, has stood down amid sexual harassment allegations. And according to various news outlets, the SNP have been aware of these allegations since 2017, going into 2018, when letters were formally submitted to the SNP. Why do you think it has taken now, 2021, as we're speaking, why do you think it's taken so long for any action regarding these accusations of sexual harassment to come to light and to be actioned in some way?
I've read what you read in the Herald newspaper today, and I think it's right that Patrick Grady, as chief whip, has stood aside while these matters are looked into. As I understand it, the complaints weren't formalised, but the party in question was given the, it was signposted to the right way of raising a complaint at the time, should that have been their wish. There are processes governing this. I understand that only recently, very recently, has that complaint been formalised as such. Of course, with all of these things, you do need to have the interests of the people at the heart of it in mind, and ensuring that you're not doing anything expressly against their wishes too.
Now, obviously, independence is the key platform for the SNP, the main goal, and you want to hold a referendum on that. But what is the SNP plan for if the UK government don't grant one? Would you support a wildcat referendum held without legal approval, or would you support some other steps?
I think our party has kind of made clear over the last couple of months that democracy is what should prevail in this instance. We will put an independence referendum in our manifesto this May. If that succeeds in returning a pro-independence majority, then we will go ahead, and there's legislation already in the works, we will go ahead with taking that forward. We will look towards a date, a time, a mechanism, an electorate, all the trappings that go with organising a referendum, and on that basis, I think there will be general support throughout the Scottish population for not for necessarily independence per se, but for Scotland's right to choose our own future. It's important that we don't rush into it. I think there is still a pandemic going on, but actually there is light at the end of the tunnel there too, and so part of what Scotland's recovery looks like and coming out of this pandemic could be helped considerably by having more of the powers, particularly the macroeconomic levers, to make a real difference, to invest now, to realize the benefits down the line. And I think we've said in recent months that we will continue on that trajectory, and frankly woe betide any UK government that tries to deny Scotland that right, or drag this through the courts.
Now, on the point of independence, looking at some of the recent polling, support for independence has fallen slightly, somewhat seemingly in relation to the evidence that Nicola Sturgeon gave before the inquiry into the allegations regarding Alex Salmond. Do you think that this demonstrates that independence, in the view of some people in the Scottish electorate, is too closely tied to Nicola Sturgeon? And do you think, therefore, if that is the case, that she has now become a liability to the SNP and the Scottish independence movement?
I mean, there's absolutely no question that she has not become a liability. You look at her personal approval ratings, compared to other political leaders across the UK, and she's absolutely streets ahead. People trust her. They trust her leadership. They trusted the way that she's led Scotland through the pandemic over the past year. Put it this way, there's 23 polls on the trot now showing support for independence at historically high levels. You would expect them to bounce up and down a wee bit. The last couple haven't been quite such good reading for supporters of independence, but the 20 before that were extremely encouraging. I think that support for independence, for Scotland's right to choose our future, is probably bigger than any personalities. That said, leadership, good leadership, trust in government, trust in the direction of the country, and I suppose confidence in securing that future are what matter more than Nicola Sturgeon or any other politician. And I think particularly contrasting the approach of Nicola Sturgeon, which has been cautious, it's been confident over the last year, with what's the comparison? Boris Johnson, who I don't think on many readings people would say has led the UK with purpose or confidence or much success over the last year. And when you're comparing the two of them, I think people, if they're going to draw these conclusions based on personality, then they are drawn to one conclusion or the other. I think there's been plenty of sort of anecdotal evidence. I certainly know it from my own family that having never been fans of Nicola Sturgeon before or the SNP, they have been very impressed by the way that she's handled and conducted herself over the last year. That's great. She's an asset. But I think the wider point about confidence and belief in Scotland standing on its own two feet is a much bigger thing.
If Scotland does leave the UK, what kind of role do you see for the SNP afterwards? And what role would you see for unionist parties going forward? Because obviously there's still going to be millions of people who voted no, even if you win independence. So how do you think you can bring the country together after that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. And the last thing you would want to do as a party that delivers independence would be to gloat or to suggest that this is a country, a new nation that you're in the process of creating that is no welcoming home for those who perhaps weren't convinced of the merits of independence. So I think a real responsibility there on the shoulders of the SNP once we get to that point. There's often, people discuss whether would the SNP survive independence? Would the party even continue to exist once it had, achieved its raison d'etre? And I think there would be. I think the prevailing political mood in Scotland is left of centre social democratic. That's what the SNP embodies. I think it would continue to provide leadership through the transition, and then thereafter it's up to the people of Scotland to decide who they want. I think there are genuinely unionist politicians in Scotland who would be very, very helpful in that process of nation building. There are very bright people amongst the Tory ranks, amongst Labour ranks, who believe firmly in the project of devolution, in gaining more powers for the Scottish Parliament over the years, and actually think that certain powers over borrowing, over taxation, over our relationship with the rest of the world should be exercised here in Scotland. And actually, I think bringing them on board as part of that huge task to build a new nation is very, very important.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to have you on, Fergus. And I have one final question. We've, of course, discussed coronavirus and the impact that has had on all of our lives. And of course, we're still in a national lockdown at the moment, though it is beginning to ease thanks to vaccination. So my final question to you is this. What one thing that you haven't been able to do because of coronavirus are you most looking forward to being able to do again when things are at a more normal level as they were before coronavirus?
I think seeing family is a huge one. Sadly, we lost my grandfather earlier this year. He was in a care home, and they had an outbreak of coronavirus, and he was suffering from dementia and had gone downhill, and unfortunately that was the final straw. I haven't been able to see my granny and give her a hug since that happened, and that would probably be pretty high up on the agenda. Thereafter, I think a trip to the pub with some friends would be pretty high up the agenda too. It might sound a bit kind of glib, but I've really missed seeing people. I'm naturally a people person, and not having that over the last few months has been pretty wearing. What about you guys?
Well, hopefully, as you say, seeing family and getting out to the pub would be something that very much be high on my agenda.
Yeah, I think the pub as well is that's the cornerstone to me of like normality. If the pubs are open, then we're on the right track, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it's been great to speak to you, Fergus. If people want to find out more about your campaign, where should they go to find out more about it?
Go to my website at fergusmuch.scot, or you can find me on Twitter at Fergoodness, which is a ridiculous handle, or on Facebook, Fergus Much SNP.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.